The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Kumbaya, everybody. Welcome to episode 73 of The Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson, and my guest today is Nick Santa Maria. We'll talk about him in a little bit. I'm recording this on Sunday, September 14th, 2014, which is the 100th birthday of Clayton Moore. I hope you listened to last week's commentary track with the panel discussion that we did at CineCon with Don Moore and Jay Thomas and Rob Word. I've gotten a lot of good comments about that, and a lot of people are still laughing at Jay Thomas's story. And if you haven't heard it, I suggest you do. But today's the actual day, and I celebrated it by roasting to death. Well, not to death. I'm clearly talking now, so I was almost bereft of life. We went up to Iverson Ranch in Chatsworth, which is where the exterior scenes in the Lone Ranger TV series were filmed, and most specifically where the great shot in the opening sequence of every episode where the Lone Ranger rears up on silver in front of that great rock, which we now call Lone Ranger Rock. We were standing right there. I was being interviewed for a little TV thing that's being put together about Clayton Moore, and Dawn Moore, his daughter, was out there. It was miserably hot. It was, as Neil Simon and Matthew Broderick would say, Africa hot. It was rough. However, as you know about me, I love being in certain places at certain times, and being at Lone Ranger Rocks and with the perils of Nioka Cliffs right behind me, it seemed the perfect thing to do to celebrate the 100th birthday of Clayton Moore, so I was happy to do it. I only fainted a couple of times, and then they dragged me to my car and turned on the air conditioner, and once I revived, I drove home to go to sleep. So, all in all, a good day, right? Today's guest is Nick Santa Maria. I've known Nick for a relatively short time. I've known him casually for probably a couple of years, but really haven't sat around and talked much until fairly recently. One of the things that we had to talk about was that he is one of the two stars of Michael Schlesinger's, let's say, faux 30s two-reel shorts as the comedy team Biffle and Schuster. Michael made one film called It's a Frame-Up with them last year, and this past summer has produced five more two-reelers, well, four more two-reelers and one one-reeler. One's a Vitaphone short. Mike spent a great deal of thought in making it look like a real 1930s short, and Nick plays Biffle. I hope I'm right on that one. I can only remember because I think he yells, Schuster, at one point. And if he wasn't being self-referential, then he was talking about the other guy. But he really does know how to do that kind of comedy. And I think there are probably very few chances in life these days to act out that kind of comedy. They were doing the Niagara Falls sketch in one of the shorts. And so, since I am planning and hoping to do a documentary based around that sketch, I went to spend the day there shooting B-roll. I shot all of their rehearsals. I shot all of the various performances. And they did a good job of recreating that classic burlesque bit. And he had three really gifted women who would come out and beat the snot out of him every time he said Niagara Falls, and it was funny indeed. And it was one of those rare examples where a director would periodically come out and say to his cast, bigger, be bigger. He really got it out of them, and it was a lot of fun. So it'll be a nice thing if I ever get this documentary going, and Lord knows if I ever will, but it's going to be nice to have a couple of newish things in it. Like that. And also, I'll give you a little heads up early if you don't know about it. There was a play on Broadway called The Nants, starring Nathan Lane. I think it played last year. And for whatever reason, it was recorded and played actual movie theaters this past summer for one day only. And then it's going to play on PBS this fall, I believe in October, but check your local listings, won't you? But it's about a burlesque performer, Nathan Lane, who does a Nance act. And for those of you who aren't burlesque aficionados, a Nance act was a real over-the-top, effeminate gay character. It was not unlike a person doing blackface or some other really strongly stereotypical kind of comedy based on race, and in this case, on sexual orientation. This play is basically a drama in and of itself, but there are lots of burlesque sketches that intersperse the drama, and one of them is Niagara Falls. So the sketch continues to live, and that's one of the reasons that I'm so interested in it, is that it goes back as far as it does. It still retains some kind of currency, because even people who don't know the sketch have a vague memory, at least, of when you say, "Slowly I turn." If you don't know the bit, why are you listening to my podcast? This is Comedy 101 for a podcast like this. But Nick Santa Maria did a wonderful job in that sketch and in the other sketches that I saw him doing. And he really knows his comedy history. So this was a great time for me to talk a little bit about his career. And then we just started talking like comedy fans about people we like and people we don't like. And there are a couple that he tries to convince me of that I'm not quite sold on. And, you know, I don't close the door on anybody. So, yes, I'm saying, Ritz Brothers, there's still a chance that I could turn the corner on you. Because Nick makes a good defense of the Ritz Brothers, but they've never made me laugh. But as I say, I don't hold out any kind of animosity about it. I'm gonna keep giving them a try until they click, because I would rather laugh than not laugh. So enjoy my conversation with Nick Santa Maria, and I'll talk to you on the other side. Now, as it turns out, I saw you before I knew you. By a long shot. I went to the L.A. production of The Producers.
Oh. Oh, my goodness.
Don't worry about that.
I'm still bringing down the house.
It's one of my awards.
Oh, is that an award?
See, that's my clever way of bringing it in. I drop it off the wall.
You've always been off the wall. You don't mind my saying so.
You were in the production of The Producers that I saw. Is that correct?
Yes.
With Martin Short.
Yes, and Jason Alexander.
Yeah.
That was at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood.
And I only noticed recently when I was looking you up on the internet, in which I found that you work as a web designer in Australia.
Yes.
So,
yes, I do.
So
I make upside down websites.
I thank you for coming all this way for this.
Absolutely,
your own expense. Which is
nice. It was actually quite inexpensive and very convenient. I knew a kangaroo who was jumping over here. He had some room in his pouch. I got in, and here I am.
Well,
that's why I'm going up and down involuntarily right now. So please forgive me.
I do forgive you.
Thank you.
And this conversation will go up and down too, as it already has.
Let's hope so. In intelligence. I hope.
But you were also in the movie version of The Producers.
Yes, right? I was. Very, very briefly. And there's a story behind that. Susan Stroman, the director of the play, got the opportunity to direct the movie. And what she did, to her credit, was to hire as many of the stage people to appear in the film. So the film, in essence, is like a yearbook for those of us who were with the show for 4 years or more. But I never got along with her assistant choreographer, a guy named Warren Carlyle, who was recently up for a Tony, I believe. I don't know if he won or not. I think he did. But anyway, we didn't get along at all. I'm not a dancer, and I hate learning choreography. So he put me behind like a pole. You can hardly see me in the movie. And that's fine with me because I think it's a lousy movie.
Hmm. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
You were in the Broadway production as well?
I am.
Were you playing the same role?
No, it's an interesting story. Another interesting story that has to do with Susan Stroman. When I auditioned for the show, I went to New York, and they had to do something very, very unusual. I don't know if it was the first. My agent told me it was, but you know how agents are. My audition apparently was so good that they offered me a contract, and they had to work this out with Actors Equity, where I would be available to cover 90% of the male roles in the show.
Yikes.
That was everybody except Leo and Carmen Gia, who were played by much smaller people. But I was available to both national tours and the Broadway company. So I was flown wherever they needed me, and they had to get permission from Equity for that. So it was interesting, and I got to work with a lot of nice people. I got to play every role, practically, except those two I mentioned. And I just wish it were more fun. It wasn't a lot of fun.
Not fun because it was grueling, or because you felt that it wasn't being handled very well?
Well, before I came to the producers, I originated the role of the genie in Disney's Aladdin, a musical spectacular, which is still running after 11 years at the Hyperion Theater at California Adventure. But I was the first genie, and somebody from the producers saw me, and that's when I next, you know, flew into New York. The genie allowed me to ad-lib and to rewrite my show every day, basically. And I assumed that going to work for Mel Brooks, it was going to be a very creative, open kind of experience, and that's how I went into it. And I found out it was just the opposite. Hmm. When a choreographer directs, it means everything is down to, you know, don't lift your eyebrow that high, or, you know, stand over an inch to the right when you deliver this front line. It was very, very grueling, very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? I felt like a prisoner, really. But wow, the money was so good, I stayed with it for 4 years plus.
I know that feeling.
Yeah,
yeah. I met a guy one time just a couple of years ago who was in the movie version of The Odd Couple,
mm-hmm,
and was one of the poker-playing buddies.
Yeah.
And he said it was just like that with Neil Simon, that Neil Simon wanted it done specifically the way it had been done on the stage.
Right.
Instead of having guys saying, okay, I'll see you this and I'll, you know, raise you that. No. No, it had to be exactly word for word, gesture for gesture.
Yep.
And he said it was a living hell. He said the entire production on his part was just horrible.
Yeah. So. I'm a friend of Lou Stadlin, Louis J. Stadlin. I don't know if you know him. He played Groucho in Minnie's Boys back in 69, and since then nominated for a Tony for Candide and took over for Nathan Lane in The Producers. So we often commiserated about the hell it was. I'm forgetting my original point. Lou Stadlin, what were you just
talking about? Odd Couple.
The Odd Couple. Yeah. He actually originated a few Neil Simon shows and said that Neil is a complete stickler about every word, every pause being just right. And since then, I've done a lot of Neil Simon, and it's like learning a language. The rhythms, the where your punchlines fall, it's all beautifully, beautifully constructed, a lot more so than Mel Brooks, who is kind of he's more hokey, a little more corny.
Yeah.
You know? So you would hope you'd have some play, you know, to sell this stuff. But in The Producers, I would listen to jokes bomb night after night after night and know that it could have used a rewrite or it could have used a different way of you know, saying it. But you couldn't. Your hands were tied. It was pretty terrible.
Did you get to work with Brooks himself at all?
Yeah, Brooks was there, especially when we put up the Las Vegas production. He was there quite a bit. And, you know, he's a nice guy. He's a megalomaniac. Everything's about him, you know. But he's Mel Brooks. What are you going to do?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought that he would be a great guy to have dinner with.
Yes.
Don't know that he would be a great guy to work with.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
again, Lou Stadlin did To Be or Not to Be, that terrible remake Brooks made, and said that Brooks put him through hell. He was just hell to work with.
Wow.
It was... You know, he's got a huge ego, a huge ego. And as I get older, I'm learning to use ego less and less to get what I need or whatever. But it seems to be getting worse with Mr. Brooks. What else was I going to tell you about that? No, that's pretty much it. My first appearance at the Pantages, I was totally unaware of the fact that I had to stick to everything in the script, you know, to the letter. I went on and did 10 minutes in the audition scene. I was the guy who comes up and says,
for the last 15 years, I've toured in No, Nietzsche.
You played Nietzsche?
No.
That whole bit. I turned it into this whole pantomime bit where I got my thumbs caught in my belt, and then I knocked my hat off, which was one of those, like, Kaiser helmets with the point.
Yeah.
And then I'd put it back on, and I'd, like, hit it like it was a top hat, and I'd hurt myself on the point. Anyway, I did this whole bit. And Jason Alexander and Martin Short are off to the side watching, and they're banging on the table. They're hysterical. They're laughing so hard. After the scene, Martin Short actually ran around the backstage area, found me, grabbed me, hugged me, and said, "Nick, you are a comic genius." This is from one of my heroes, one of my all-time heroes. And the next day, all of my business was out of the show. So there you go. That's the frustration I had to deal with.
Well, tell me about working with Martin Short, because you and I share, among other things, but we do share a reverence for SCTV.
SCTV, the greatest.
The greatest.
Sketch comedy show, I think, of all time.
Yeah, I do too.
Marty was, he was like a, all right, I know the perfect way to describe Marty. Working with him was a ball, because there was always something else going on with Marty. There was the show, and then there was the show for everyone on stage. So that I loved about him. He had a, in his dressing room, he had a sock puppet on his couch. And it was a snake's body with a rabbit's head. And it looked very old. And I asked him about it. And he said, years ago, when he was in Second City in Canada, one of the girls in the company made him that puppet. It's called a rabbit snake. And he said, when she gave it to me, she said, "This is you. You're cute like a bunny and you know, whatever, but you could be a snake at a moment's notice." And he kept it, and he knew that about him. And it's true. Marty was a wonderful, wonderful guy, a great, great performer, but that went up to a point. And then if you stepped on his toes or if he felt insecure, then he would have to, you know, whatever, go to the front office or say something or whatever. I personally, and I'm not bragging here, when I took over in the producers, when I went to the Pantages, Arnold Schwarzenegger had just come in as governor. It was the big news. Gray Davis was out and Arnold Schwarzenegger was in. Well, that night I was playing the role of the prisoner who runs on while Max and Leo are in prison. I come on with a letter saying they've been pardoned by the governor, and I'm supposed to read it to them. I ran on stage, and I went, guys, look, this just came from the governor. And I said, listen. And I went, gentlemen, you are hereby granted a full pardon. That's all the audience needed to hear. They laughed, really, for like a full minute, and then into applause. And we just stood there, the three of us, Jason, Marty, and I. And Jason kind of looked at me with admiration in his eyes. It was a wonderful thing. Marty didn't look at me at all. And the next day, it was out of the show.
Wow.
So anyway, that's Marty. Great guy, wonderful performer. Maybe the best we have, I think, as far as comedy. I think he's brilliant.
Did he ever regale you with SCTV stories, or did you ask him?
He wasn't about the past. He was one of those guys that was about now, what am I doing now? He was doing Jiminy Glick at the time, and I was a big fan. So I usually made an idiot of myself when I was around him, because he's really one of my heroes. You know?
I spent the day with Catherine O'Hara one time when
the best we have.
Yeah, mm-hmm. When I was doing A Nightmare Before Christmas event at Disneyland, and I believe I behaved with a David Niven-esque savoir-faire throughout. But according to my wife, I was just following Catherine around all day saying, hey, Catherine, I can stand on my head. Do you want to see me? Hey, look at this funny thing I can do.
You know? I can't say that I wouldn't do the same thing. You know, anyone who loves comedy or just talent would have a crush on Catherine.
Well, sure, of course.
I still do.
Yeah, and it's it goes back so far because those SCTV shows started in the late 70s. So
that's right, yeah.
It's, man, oh, man. We're pushing 40 years since that thing started.
God, I don't know how I understood them at the age of one. It's amazing.
I had my parents write out, give me reference points. Now, you started out, you've always been a movie buff.
Oh, yeah.
And you love silent film and all of that.
And 1928 to 1934, my favorite period in film.
So how did that get started? Was it TV for you?
Yeah, of course it was TV. I became, as a very young child, I think I was five when I first saw Lou Costello on the screen. And I think it was the television show first and then films. I fell in love. I fell in love with Lou Costello. I wanted to be Lou Costello. And my parents weren't very, they were kind of distant. And as a young child, I used to try to find ways to get their attention or to be able to relate to them on some level. And I noticed that when they got together with their friends, inevitably it would come around to old films, the films they grew up watching. And I could see how much they loved talking about it, and the laughter would ensue, and they'd talk about favorite scenes and favorite movie stars. So I think that got into my system, and I realized, well, if I learned about that, I'd have something to talk to them about. And this was my young, I'm talking like 4 or 5 years old. So I became a lunatic. I became a walking sponge for this stuff. And eventually, by the time I was like 9 years old, I was like an encyclopedia. I would literally memorize the TV guide for that week so I wouldn't miss anything. And people would ask me, like, instead of picking up the TV guide, it's like, ask Nick, you know, what's on right now? And I could rattle off what was on. And that's kind of strange because now I don't watch television. In fact, I stopped about almost 30 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I don't watch a lot of network television, or haven't. People are really surprised to hear what I haven't seen on television. And I don't miss it, really. And I know a lot of it is good. I have better things to do, really. But I think that's the reason. And then the Marx Brothers came into my life, and that just put me over the edge. My specialty became vintage comedy. And that's really how it started.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York. I was born in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and grew up on Long Island in a town called Massapequa. We had a few people come out of Massapequa. We had Jerry Seinfeld and the Baldwin brothers. You'll forgive us.
Don't know any of those.
You don't know any of those names? The Stray Cats.
Ah.
Okay, there we go.
There you go.
I knew I'd connect on some level.
So how young were you when you started being able to go into the city and see things on film?
Well, the city was something you went to with your parents. And I remember them taking me to see my communion. For my first communion, they took us to the city, and we went to Radio City for the first time. I did, Radio City Music Hall. And they were still showing films at the time. And I remember being enthralled. Number one, the Rockettes just drove me absolutely nuts. And I had to marry a woman who was that tall and leggy, and did eventually. My first wife was 6 foot. But the movie was Two for the Road. And I thought it was an odd choice for someone in second grade. You know, they actually swore in that film.
Wow.
And it was the late 60s. We weren't used to that. It was like 67, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being very, very impressed that our parents allowed myself and my brothers and sister to sit through this movie. But it was just such an amazing thing. And I'm sure that also drove home my wanting to be in show business, you know. That's a magical place, a wonderful place. But the city, I didn't really go to many revivals in the city, even though I was only about a half hour away by train. We had a place called the Mini Cinema in Uniondale, Long Island. And they were – this little theater was somewhat responsible for the resurgence of the Marx Brothers. They catered to the college crowds.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw – most of the Marx Brothers movies there for the first time. I remember sitting through a double feature of Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, and seeing those films for the first time. And I don't think I've ever heard laughter like that in a theater since, before or since.
Yeah, I long for those days in one way, because you would never pack out a college theater with the Marx Brothers today. And when I was in college, you could do it without even thinking about it.
Oh, all you'd have to say is Marx, and you get a full house.
As a matter of fact, at the Harvard Street Theater in Cambridge, they would play, oh, doggone it, the one with Ann Miller.
Room Service.
Room Service. For some reason, and I've never understood why, but they played that one repeatedly.
I don't understand.
I don't know why, but and I went several times.
Maybe a hotel fetish?
It could be. Yes. Lucille Ball's in it. Maybe that's it.
But
the place was packed, and it was a huge theater, and it was always packed.
Well, even the Mini Cinema, I mean, they would show something like Go West, which I think is the worst the Marx Brothers ever did. It would be packed, and they'd laugh at every line. You know, you have to be a little suspect about that, too, because, you know, they could have shown footage of, you know, Groucho soaking cotton swabs, and they would have laughed and applauded and said, what a genius.
I'd like to see that, yeah.
Oh, you never saw the cotton swab?
No, I never did. I've heard about it.
Oh, yeah.
It's apparently in South America is the only print. But I remember when Animal Crackers was re-released. Mm-hmm. That must have been around 73, 74, something like that.
74, 75, around there. That was my buddy Steve Stolyar.
Yeah. Who's been on this podcast.
Yeah.
And
I was wondering what that was.
Yeah. And I banned him for life.
There we go. Oh, you did.
Great guy. And I went to see that thing every day that it was there.
I don't blame you.
Kenmore Square Theater in Boston, mm-hmm. and played for a week, and I was there every day for that week. It's interesting because that movie is kind of symbolic of how, as I learned more about film and about theater, my feelings about that film evolved almost entirely into something else, which was when I first saw it, all the musical numbers and all the stage kind of stuff, mm-hmm. was just something that I would endure to get back to the Marx Brothers.
Right.
But then when I realized what a perfect example it was of actually capturing a stage production of that time on film, just as Marx, as the Coconuts was.
Right. But more so.
But more so. Yeah. It's very specifically that show, and it has all the entrances, the stage entrances, everything is
even
there.
Even the level of performance.
Yeah. It's all there. And so it starts becoming this valuable document after a while.
Yeah.
And once I, for some reason, why in the world Lillian Roth eluded me at first.
Isn't she great?
She's great.
Yeah.
And
that
song that the
Why Am I So?
It's a great song.
It is. And she's terrific.
Yeah.
He'll get to the bottom of this, you know?
Yeah. She's,
and we'll be married and divorced in no time. It's great stuff.
And she's playing it with a certain snide outsiders. I mean,
it's tongue in cheek.
She's playing with the lines, and she's great.
I think so, too.
So,
I actually saw a bootleg of Animal Crackers the year before it was re-released. It was a muddy print, you know. It was at this Mini Cinema in Uniondale, mm-hmm. a midnight show, kept kind of under the radar. And I loved it. I just loved it, even with the muddy print. It was such a revelation. The weird thing about Animal Crackers is that, you know, of course it wasn't part of the television packages or anything, but there was that record album, that LP, Marx Brother album, where every other chunk was from Animal Crackers. So I felt like I'd heard the movie before I actually saw it.
Yeah, besides the Marx Brothers, who else really caught your eye at that time?
Oh, at that time it was the Abbott and Costello were shown, I think, most of all on New York television. We had, at one point, we had two Abbott and Costello movies every Saturday, two different ones, and then one every Sunday. So I got to see their movies before I think I saw everyone else's. W.C. Fields, who I placed probably placed second behind Groucho as the greatest film comedian, talking film comedian of all time. But I've since, as I get older, I notice that Fields is actually the better comedian, I think. He's got more to offer.
I think so, too. I think he's the best there is.
I don't think anyone's ever been better. Yeah. And right up to now, Fields, by far, was probably the funniest man to work in front of a camera, I think. And the talkies, I should say. His silence, I don't really care for much.
I've only seen a couple of those, and they're fine. You know, they're fine. They're okay, but he needs his voice.
I feel that way about Laurel and Hardy, too. A lot of people are in love with their silent films, and I think they're okay. They haven't really found the characters yet, and they're very... derivative of each other. A lot of people give Leo McCarey credit for the whole reciprocal destruction thing. And it's true. He did come up with that. But they used it in film after film after film. Oh, look, they're ripping people's pants off. Oh, look, they're throwing pies. Oh, look, they're undoing ties or whatever it is. It gets a little dull for me. I like their talkies. I think once they hit their stride in talkies, like around 30, late 30, 31, no team ever better. As much as I love Abbott and Costello, they didn't match Laurel and Hardy.
Nobody can.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I found Laurel and Hardy from my earliest childhood, because that was what played constantly on television where I live.
Right.
That and Our Gang were the two live-action shorts that we saw all the time.
Right.
The Three Stooges saw frequently, but Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang, we saw every day.
Right, right.
And the silent films of Laurel and Hardy are still kind of a novelty to me, because I've seen most of the existing silent films, I think, and some I like and some I just accept. Mm-hmm. But they're not deep in my soul like, you know,
the talkies,
like Busybodies or which I know line for line and image for image, you know.
Mine is Toad in a Hole. That's my favorite. I love Toad in a Hole. Laurel and Hardy, I think, really were so much better once you heard their voices.
Yeah.
They were so perfect for those characters. And what a wonderful thing. I mean, not even Charlie Chase, who I think suffered a little bit because he was inured in that silent style of acting, you know, even when he was doing talkies. And, you know, I love Charlie Chase, but Laurel and Hardy, it was like a duck to water. It was just, it was perfect. But we had Laurel and Hardy in a half-hour format. You know, I remember WOR, Channel 9, used to have Laurel and Hardy Theater. But I have to confess, and I'm not proud of this, but when I was a child, I found them much too slow. The pacing was much too slow. And, you know, Stan would say that they weren't made for television. They were made for theater audiences. And I just couldn't get used to it. I found it very predictable. I had enough time to figure out the gags, you know, before they got there. So Abbott and Costello were the ones for me because they were fast and funny and furious. Then as I got older, I started realizing what Laurel and Hardy were doing. And it's almost subversive, you know, what they do, and it's just so much more intricate. And I could discuss their characters for hours, you know. Whereas, you know, you say Abbott and Costello, well, you know, Costello was the innocent, dumb guy, and Abbott was Abbott was almost like a funny villain, in a way, you know. Gotta love him.
I've talked about them with other people, and I think what keeps me from loving them is that they didn't have any affection for each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
on screen.
Yeah, on screen. Mm-hmm. Abbott would take advantage of Costello under any circumstances, would sell him out at the drop of a hat.
Oh, right.
Never cared. Whereas that would never happen with Laurel and Hardy.
Well, and again, it's
Laurel and Hardy would fight with each other.
Right, which like brothers do, or like married couples do, more appropriately.
Yeah.
But Abbott and Costello came from burlesque, and
absolutely,
that was a typical burlesque relationship, and that's how I accepted it. You know, it's funny. I went to see a screening of Whodunit at the where was it? The Alex Theater, I believe it was. And I brought along a friend of mine, Scott Ratner, also a terrific film buff and historian. But Scott was not a, he didn't grow up watching Abbott and Costello. In fact, a lot of their movies he's never seen before. And he was seeing Whodunit for the first time. And on the way home, he mentioned that he didn't understand Abbott's place in the act. He just didn't understand it. Who was he? Why was he pushing Lou into these dangerous, you know, things, knowing that this is his friend and, you know, he would even get some of the repercussions and blah, blah, blah. And all I said to him was, there's really not a lot to understand. That's their relationship. It's a burlesque relationship, yeah. And you either accept it or you don't. And I've been accepting it since I was a little kid. So I have to disagree with you. I actually love Abbott and Costello, and I love their relationship for what it is. But it doesn't have the depth and the beauty of Laurel and Hardy's screen partnership.
Yeah, there are Abbott and Costello films that I really love. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And most of all, I think The Time of Their Lives, which I think is my favorite of theirs.
Atypical, but a great film.
But I take their films one at a time.
Yeah.
Unlike Laurel and Hardy's, which, even though they did do the same decline as the Marx Brothers did later on.
Right.
I just sort of stay away from those. I politely avoid some of the later ones.
The Laurel and Hardy?
Yeah.
I actually have a new appreciation for their Fox films. I mean, I realize that they're not, you know, some of them are very unsuited, and we're dealing with the 1940s and Nazis and the gangsters with the fedoras and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they're still Laurel and Hardy.
Sure they are,
you know? I may not be able to – I think Haunting We Will Go is my least favorite. But as far as The Big Noise, Jitterbugs, The Dancing Masters, and especially The Bullfighters, which I would put up with some of their later Roach stuff, I find it all kind of pleasant. I kind of like it.
I can watch any of them, and I think The Bullfighters has some genuinely funny stuff in it.
I laugh out loud.
Really funny stuff in it. And I've never seen Atal K.
Oh, I have. It's not bad.
I think it's getting a kind of reassessment these days.
Yeah, they're looking at it again.
Yeah.
I just think I have to give them credit for, number one, trying a new idea, a very modern idea, but doing it in their old-fashioned Laurel and Hardy way.
Yeah.
You know, it's a mess. You know, it's a European mess. People are speaking different languages. The dubbing is a little disconcerting, but they're still Laurel and Hardy, and despite the fact that Ollie looks like a parade float and Stan looks like, you know, he died and was reanimated, they're still Laurel and Hardy, and they do some pretty good stuff in it. So I like it better than A Haunting We Will Go or Nothing But Trouble, you know, at MGM.
I hope I will see it one of these days. I just never gotten the opportunity, and every time I did get close to it, it would be like a dupe of a dupe or something like that.
You want to get a nice copy.
No, I may as well see it under its best circumstances.
Yeah, something like that, you want to definitely, you know, you want to stack the deck in your favor so you'll enjoy it. But it's not nearly as bad as a lot of people say it is. And again, it's Laurel and Hardy. I'm thinking of a few moments now that still make me laugh.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Charlie Chase. I know you wrote an article, at least one article, about Chase.
Uh-huh.
He's somebody that I've always been really on the fence about.
I'm with you.
Because when he's good, he's really, really good.
Yes.
But he's not always good.
No, I agree with the assessment that he was better in silent films. I really enjoy his silent films a lot more than his sound work. You know, people may not like this. Charlie Chase fans may not like to hear this, but I actually like a lot of his Columbia shorts better than his Roach shorts. They're slicker. He's a bit more modern in them.
Mm-hmm.
The Roach shorts are so hit and miss. Chase seemed to enjoy gimmicks. You know, I find his gimmick shorts they have a limited appeal with me. I enjoy the ones where it's just Chase being Chase, you know, doing his fig bar and maybe singing a couple of songs or whatever. But something like Girl Grief has some amazing moments in it. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but I've co-written a book with two of my film historian buddies, and Jeff Collins and Aaron Nethery. And it's 60 essays. It's called Comedy Crazy, 60 essays about vintage comedy. And it hasn't been released yet. It's finished. We're just kind of at that point now where we don't know where to go next. We have two publishers right now who will publish it, but we're a little lazy about finishing it up. But I do a thing, my 10 funniest scenes from films. And, of course, those changed the next day.
Sure.
But in the book, one of them is from Girl Grief, where he's leading the girls and singing this very staid, boring song, and the girls eventually turn it into like a swinging song, and he loses it. He becomes totally immersed in this music, and he starts dancing, and he doesn't really know what he's doing. And then the headmistress walks in and catches him, and he panics and falls out the window, bounces off a diving board, and lands in the swimming pool. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. So he's capable of doing stuff like that, but I don't think. Well, it's probably why he didn't become a star in features. He didn't have a very strong comic personality.
Yeah, you can never quite pin him down. I mean, Abbott and Costello, you see them and you know who they are.
Immediately.
Abbott, Laurel and Hardy, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know exactly who they are. Chase is a little bit more of an everyman, and you have to wait for the film to unfold to understand who he is this time.
Right, because sometimes he would pick like the man about town, other times he's the henpecked husband, another times he's sort of a eccentric, you know, guy into science or whatever. He never had like a strong, firm persona.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about Joey Brown, who's someone I admire very much and collect his films, but you didn't know if you were going to get the hayseed braggart or the wise guy Broadway guy or the Texan from Texas. You know what I mean? He didn't really pin down one persona.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's not better remembered. And same thing with Chase.
He tried to make his trademark his mouth.
Which you can't.
Which
you can't do, you know? <It's> like,
Martha Ray tried the same thing.
Exactly, really, exactly. Well, they were both very, very talented. In fact, I think Martha Ray is the funniest woman to ever step on a stage.
Well, Martha Ray is very funny. I just was watching her in something the other day. And I think Joey Brown is a riot.
Oh, he's wonderful.
In The Right Things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rare that I see one of his films that I dislike.
Me too.
They're almost always perfectly fine, and sometimes they're terrific.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's just one of those guys. He never quite made an impact as far as what his personality was or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, you know, it's very few of them did when you think back now.
Yeah.
Groucho's persona, the mustache, the glasses, and cigar, have become sort of a imprimatur of what comedy is. You see it at comedy clubs. You see it everywhere. If something's funny, you'll generally see Groucho's persona there somewhere. Chaplin, too, to a lesser extent, which I find interesting. Excuse me. Because I think Chaplin was it as far as comedy. And comedians, I don't think anyone was ever, ever better than Chaplin. And I don't think anyone will ever attain that artistry, that comedic artistry. But anyway, even Chaplin's forgotten now. You know, you can go to young people and show them pictures and they won't know. They don't know for the most part.
Yeah, I'm torn on that issue, whether we should be trying to figure out a way to make these things live to the next generation. Or do we just say, the world moves on? And
I look at it like people look at, animals disappearing off the face of the earth. There's nothing you can really do about that. It's nature, and it happens. It's the same thing with this. You can't force feed people.
Yeah.
You know, how many times do you want to grab some kid who's laughing at the Three Stooges and saying, "These are the Marx Brothers. Look at the Marx Brothers." You can't do it. They'll resent you, for one thing.
Yeah.
And everything's cyclical. You know, it'll be back. Everything comes back eventually.
Yeah, there are still people who perform restoration comedy.
Yes,
you know,
it's true.
Not many people watch it, but they still do it.
Uh-huh. No, it's Shakespeare. You look at Shakespeare. It's a whole other language, you know, and it's a specialized thing.
Yet it lives.
Yeah, and it lives.
And opera. I think there are many things like that. And I just, you know, I always think, well, how much longer am I going to live?
Yeah.
I'll still have Laurel and Hardy for the rest of my life, so really, who cares?
Who cares? Yeah, I mean, and the way things are now,
yeah.
For better or worse, we have access to everything.
Yeah.
You know? And I do kind of miss looking forward all week to like a television broadcast of, you know, the old-fashioned way with W.C. Fields. I would plan my whole week around
sure.
it.
Sure.
Whether I had to, and sometimes I had to fake being sick from school to be home. My whole life was about being home to watch the movie. It's amazing. And we have things like CineCon as well. I mean, yeah. CineCon's coming up. I don't know if this is going to be broadcast before CineCon.
It's probably going to be, but who knows?
Well,
in my
if it is, I'm urging anyone who has even the slightest interest in film to stop by and maybe even get a day pass or come to the whole thing. It's very reasonable. It's I think it's the best vintage film festival out there.
I do too.
And my friend Stan Tathel and Bob Burchard, they do a wonderful job putting it together. And it's always a lot of fun. Even my girlfriend, Anne, is coming this year.
Oh, great.
Sit in and...
we're going to talk more about her in a little bit.
Yeah.
Stan Tathel was either on the... podcast recently or is about to be.
Right, right.
Depending on how these things fall.
He recorded it last week.
Yeah, he recorded it last week.
And he's my buddy.
He'll probably be on, I'm going to try to put that one on the week just prior to CineCon.
Yeah, I think that would be a good
because we do talk about it. And but the great thing about CineCon, and this is taking nothing away from all the other SlapstickCon and all the other great film festivals, but the great thing about CineCon is that they really go out of their way to show things that don't get shown otherwise.
That's what I love
so
about
So you're
it.
Not going to see Gone with the Wind. You're not going to see Now Voyager.
Oh, you mean know? We're not going to see Singing in the Rain?
You're not going to see Singing in the Rain.
You know, we'll leave that to the TCM Festival.
You're gonna be, you know, I know a little bit about film history, and I've devoted a little bit of time to it. But
Frank.
I bet 75% of what's on the schedule, I'm going, what?
I've never even heard of it. This year,
and that's the perfect thing. I love that.
This year, Stan got me to write some of the program notes on the films. And, of course, I chose usually comedies, but they're showing Buck Benny Rides Again.
Oh, man.
I mean,
yeah.
What more do you need? Buck yeah. Benny Rides Again.
And that's about as mainstream as CineCon gets.
Yeah, I agree.
But I am delighted because that is a great movie.
And I know that Stan also threw in for me a Ritz Brothers offering, One in a Million.
There. Well, okay. Sell me on the Ritz Brothers.
Okay.
Because I have not been sold. They always seem, how can I put it? They always seem really deliberate about, you know, they never seem like the comedy is just coming out spontaneously.
Right, right.
It always seems like it's being kind of jackhammered in.
Well, I can explain that
to
you.
Okay, I'd love to hear an explanation.
The Ritz Brothers. I have to tell you that coming from me, I got to meet Harry and Jimmy Ritz in Miami, which at what may have been their last live theatrical appearance. And Harry and I became buddies. So I would run into him and we'd write to each other and this and that. And he was a sweet, sweet man. Very, very encouraging to me. And the Ritz Brothers, number one, their singing and dancing they're the funniest singing, dancing trio I've ever seen. And there were knockoffs to the Ritz Brothers. When the Ritz Brothers became popular, you know, you started seeing the Slate Brothers, or all of a sudden you'll be watching this musical and three guys will show up and start doing a Ritz Brothers type routine.
Sure.
You know? But the Ritz Brothers were the best at it. And Harry in particular taught generations of comedians. And I'm talking, well, let me put it this way. Recently, somebody found an all-star review, an hour-long variety show starring the Ritz Brothers. And I got to tell you something. I'm watching this and I'm saying, Dean Martin and Jerry who? Everybody stole from Harry. Everybody. He was the first and the ultimate nut comic. He was there were nut comics before, but he was absolutely uninhibited. Whether it was appropriate for what they were doing, whether it was in the middle of a song, Harry could mug like nobody else and with and nobody with such abandon and love for what he was doing. I mean, there's something so attractive to me about that, about somebody so completely in control of his instrument and utilizing it to the, you know, the upper extreme. And then he had two spotlights on either side of him. Jimmy and Al were basically, they were talented dancers and they could sing, but they were basically there to put the spotlight on their brother. And I don't know, I just love them. I love their energy. I really like their movies. You know, The Three Musketeers is really a terrific film.
Which I've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, there's a lot of their stuff I haven't seen.
Yeah.
I just, what I have seen, I've been thinking, well, do I need to pursue this?
I'm sure.
I don't know.
The Gorilla?
Yeah.
Public Domain?
Mm-hmm.
Not their best work.
No. But, you know, I have not closed the door on anybody.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to be convinced. I'm even willing to be convinced on Harry Langdon. You know,
you have troubles with Harry Langdon.
I have
some things about him as well.
Yeah, I love some of what he did, and I do love the deliberate, slow thing, because unlike you, when I was a kid, that the slowness of Laurel and Hardy and our gang appealed to me. As a matter of fact, I can remember in A Tough Winter, when Stephen Fetchett comes in and starts taking off the gloves.
Right.
Which he does for hours.
I know. It seems like hours.
Yeah. But even when I was 6 or 7 years old, that killed me for some reason. There's another one. And
I don't know. Were we more intelligent or what at that time? Because I remember watching films like A Tough Winter, the early Our Gang stuff, even the early Laurel and Hardy stuff. And being, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years old, but being able to realize and put together that these were early talkies. These were, you know, when silent movies ended, these were their clumsy steps in trying to find their way in sound. I knew that even then, you know.
I don't know if I thought about that. I thought very much that they were from a different time.
Yes.
And that also really appealed to me. Just that their cars, their clothes.
Oh, I loved
everything.
It.
I just loved seeing.
I still do.
But when I was a child, I can remember visiting. I would spend weeks in the summer with my grandmother out in the country. And I had cousins who would come by and we were friends and would play together. And every time my grandmother would start to tell a story about when she was a child, I was riveted always.
Mm-hmm.
Because she would always say, you know, well, the girls always had to wear gloves, and you did this, and, you know, the men. And I was riveted to all of that stuff that was different. Something just went weird. But my cousins just got up and left. You know, they just didn't have any interest in that stuff at all.
Right.
And so I always wonder what that is, that I just grew up liking...
Well, I don't know.
Being able to visit the past.
I don't know if you're a believer in reincarnation.
I am not. But I tell you this, I wish that I were because it's my favorite
It's the thing that makes
alternative.
It's the thing that makes the most sense to me. You know, I'm a big believer in karma and reincarnation. And you're not just, well, in my case, when I was 3 or 4, I was drawn to things with a vaudeville mentality.
Me too.
And I never knew why. Not only was I drawn to it, but I was able to learn and absorb everything that came my way about that era.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other explanation. I was either a minstrel or a vaudevillian or whatever in those days. And I still have that residue, and it's probably why I professionally have landed in a spot where I'm one of the few people in the country that can perform that style of comedy and get away with it. And that's because I was saturated with it when I was a child.
That's a very weird coincidence, because that's the period...
You were a child too?
I was a child as well.
That is amazing.
From my earliest memories watching movies, if they would be in the dressing room of a vaudeville house, that struck me as being, oh, yeah, I know that.
It's like being home. Yeah. It was like being home. For me, it was.
Something very weird about that, and it's always been the case, mm-hmm. that I always, it's not only that I feel like this is a familiar movie scene to me, but no, it's a place that I know.
Right.
And right. I've never understood what that is. I mean, if reincarnation exists, then that's an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
I can't buy it, but I wish I could because I like the idea.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, it's, so, it comes down. I guess it comes down to that old word, faith. You know, you buy into something or you don't.
Sure.
But to me, it only seems logical. That's why I believe in it.
It does seem kind of logical to me too.
Mm-hmm.
I can't take the leap. But
that's okay.
Maybe in my next life I will.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Maybe you'll be a leaper.
Exactly.
You could live in a leaper colony.
You just
God freaked out.
All right, Father Damien.
Take me.
Now, well, taking the next logical leap, tell me about the formation of Biffle and Schuster. Well, first tell me who Biffle and Schuster are, and then tell me how you guys came up with them.
Biffle and Schuster are a comedy team from the they came up in the early 20s together. They met in a Broadway show and teamed up and went into vaudeville and eventually started making short films for an independent producer named Sam Weinberg, who released through United Artists. And they used all the great, you know, Clyde Bruckman and Preston Black and all the great supporting characters. In reality, Biffle and Schuster are a creation of my buddy Will Ryan and myself. About 6 years ago, we started performing together, doing comedy and songs, and we came up with this team, Biffle and Schuster, that we kind of adopted. Fast forward a few years, and I had written a few Biffle and Schuster animated shorts that a buddy of mine, Paul Lewis, who is actually my co-writer on Real Men, which we'll get to, I suppose, later, my musical. Do you know about that?
I do. I've seen the DVD you made of it.
Oh, you saw the DVD?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. But anyway, Paulie uses an animation program called iClone, and he would just write to me and say, write me a short. And I'd write it, send it off to him, and he would animate it and do the voices. And before you know it, we had a cartoon, a Biffle and Schuster cartoon. There's about five of them on the internet. One morning, I posted a picture of Will and I as Biffle and Schuster. This was during a photo session we did. And we were popping out of this picture frame. And Michael Schlesinger saw the posting on Facebook and wrote underneath it, it's a frame-up. And I wrote back to him and said, boy, that sounds like the title of a two-reel comedy, it's a frame-up. And he wrote back and said, hey, that's a great idea. We could take Biffle and Schuster and blah, blah, blah. So I wrote a treatment for the first short, and it turned out to be a little too elaborate for Mr. Schlesinger's budget. And he wrote one, and it turns out we shot it at the Chiodo Brothers studio about a year and a half ago. And that led to five more shorts that we just shot in July. So all through July, we were doing Biffle and Schuster two-reelers and one-reeler. We did a Vitaphone short they did in 1928.
Mm. I'm glad that one's been unearthed.
Yeah. Wait till you see it. You might want to put it back in the earth. But we did four two-reelers and the one-reeler. And one of them is being shown at Cinecon that Friday night, Labor Day weekend, at 5:40. I think it's 5:40. So that'll be the first look at the first short we shot, which is called Imitation of Wife.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's Biffle and Schuster.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and of course, I was there.
You were there when we were shooting Schmoboat.
2 weeks ago, I guess.
Yeah.
And you were shooting the Niagara Falls scene.
That's right. That's right.
And I told you later that I would bring your girlfriend Anne back up again later in the. And now is the time.
Yeah. Oh,
because she's one of the three girls in the.
Yeah.
In the bit.
Well, Mr. Schlesinger wrote a version of the old Niagara Falls bit. Slowly I turn, and he. He put three lovely, talented women As the people who suck me in and get me to say Niagara Falls so they could pretty much beat the crap out of me. And one of them is my girlfriend, Anne Montavon, who is a very, very talented actor, singer, dancer, comedian. And I thought she was wonderful in it, wasn't she?
She was committed.
Yeah, she really did. Or she should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, well.
For being your girlfriend, that's one.
But she's beautiful. She's a lovely girl.
But, yeah, it was great fun for me because.
Noel Marion and Jill Marie Burke were the other two lovely women.
Yeah. And it was it's a really funny adaptation of the bit.
Thank you.
And as you know, this is a bit that I'm studying these days because I hope to make a documentary about.
Well, you were there with the camera.
The Long Path. So yeah. I shot 2 hours of B-roll that day. And
well, it was a B-movie.
Yeah. All
right.
I wanted to ask you about being one of the Jerrys on Buffalo Bill.
Oh.
Now, this was.
That's a badness.
This was a TV series, a late lamented TV series,
yes,
I think.
It was quality.
From the late 80s, I would say 87?
Actually, that was
86?
No, it was before that. It was like 1982.
Really?
Yeah. It was that far. It was that my first television appearance.
Okay. Well, you would know. Mm-hmm. But Jim Carrey, of course, famously one of the Jerrys.
Well,
maybe the one Jerry who got the most spotlight during the episode.
Which we all felt was a little unfair because he wasn't the best Jerry. Nah. That's for sure. It was the Buffalo Bill show starring Dabney Coleman, Gina Davis, Joanna Cassidy, John Fiedler. Who else? Meshach Taylor, who just passed away.
Max Wright.
Yes, and who was very, very good. And guesting that day was that week. I was there all week, actually. Was James Cromwell. He was the nicest person on the set.
Sure.
He was fabulous. But anyway, it was an episode called Jerry Lewis Week. And the series took place in Buffalo, New York at a daytime show, TV show. And this week they were showing Jerry Lewis movies at the station. So they had this big thing where they invited all these Jerry Lewis impersonators. And, of course, we're all running wild around the studio. And I got a couple of nice shots in there. I weighed about 10 pounds and I played one of the young Jerrys. And, yeah, I was there all week long. And the beauty for me of that shoot, other than doing my first TV thing, was being on the Republic Studios lot.
Wow.
It was shot at
Radford.
Radford,
yeah.
The CBS studio. But it was MTM then. And I used to go on the Western set and eat my lunch every day. Wow. I was there for 5 days. And I was just reveling in, oh, my God, this is where all these great Westerns were filmed, and the serials and the Lidecker's and, you know, all this stuff. So that's what I was thinking about.
Yes, Vera Ruber-Ralston walked where you were walking. So.
Only the greats.
Yeah.
Only the greats. Who was their ice skating star?
Sonia Henie?
No, that was 20th Century Fox. Mm. They had their own, like Movita or... I think it was one name. I can't remember. Listeners out there, the
yes.
ice skating star at Republic Studios.
Her name was Skadia.
Well, wasn't Vera Ruber-Ralston was a skater?
She might have been.
She was. She was a skater.
There has to be some justification for her. So maybe skating was it.
I only remember her from the Fighting Kentuckian.
Oh,
Jean
man.
Breen. Ooh. Oh, Jean Breen. You know, you remember.
That was an unfortunate turn of events.
Well, Ollie was great.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yes. Oliver Hardy could have been one of the great character actors.
I agree. I
because
often say
he's
that
terrific in that, and he's wonderful in Zenobia.
He's
which is,
terrific.
Yeah, that
he's
people,
just terrific.
People
I think
don't
more
seem
so,
to see.
More so than Stan, he was a true motion picture actor and one of the best comic actors of all time.
Yeah.
I always thought he would have been great in Frank Capra's Stock Company.
Sure.
You know, playing like, you know, politicians or whatever. He would have been wonderful. He would have been wonderful. I often, in one of the chapters in my book is called What If? And we just take certain situations to see, what if, you know, Stan and Ollie did split up after Blockheads in 1938? I think Ollie would have become a very respected character actor. And I think Stan probably would have ended up at Columbia directing and writing.
Yeah.
You know? Which would have been fine.
I believe Stan would have gotten out of in front of the camera as soon as he could have.
Me too. Me too.
But I always bridle a little bit when Laurel and Hardy people will start praising Stan at the expense of Ollie. Well, Stan was the creative one, and Ollie just wanted to play golf.
They were the perfect combination.
But Ollie was great.
Ollie brought so much to the table that you couldn't possibly fault him for not being the one who stayed late at the studio or wrote the gag for the next day. If I had someone like Ollie working for me, I would be kissing the ground every day and just thanking God, because Stan had the greatest to work with. And that's not taking anything away from Stan, who was, you know, brilliant, a brilliant creative comedian. Yeah. But they were the perfect combination.
As I always say, Olivier didn't write Othello.
No, he didn't.
He did not.
Mm-mm.
And
he wasn't even black.
Not even. So,
well, the more the merrier, I always say.
Yes.
Let's go back to Harry Langdon. You mentioned that you felt that way about Langdon, that he was hit and miss, and there are certain things you like and don't like. I feel the same way about Langdon. My thing about Langdon is that he took the most chances, I think, out of all of the silent comedians.
Really?
Yeah. Langdon's stuff was actually edgy. Even his approach to comedy was edgy to me. He was changing the rhythm of comedy. That was his biggest contribution, I think. Stan Laurel wasn't the Stan Laurel we love until Harry Langdon proved it could be done, you know? And I think that's very interesting. And I think that's part of the reason Langdon had a career at the Roach Studios when he wasn't getting acting work anymore. I think Stan had a lot to do with that. And I think Stan was grateful to him for that. Stan had two major influences, as far as I'm concerned, about film. And one was Harry Langdon, who taught him that slowing things down was actually a good thing. But the other was Oliver Hardy. Yeah. We wouldn't have the Stan we love if it weren't for Ollie bringing it out in him. You know, Ollie set the rhythm.
Sure. Well, I appreciate Langdon's sense of rhythm,
mm-hmm.
and I appreciate his sense of character.
Yes.
And there are wonderful moments where that is all that it takes to get the laugh.
Yeah.
I can't remember. It's been so long since I've watched the Langdon films, but there's one where he's on a railroad car,
mm-hmm.
and a man does something to insult him or to hurt his feelings or something, and Langdon just looks at him kind of sideways, like he did, and for a long time, and then pops him in the nose. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's just a really funny, it's very deliberate.
Very slow.
Very slow. Mm-hmm. And that is beautiful work.
Yeah.
In terms of creating gags.
Wasn't that the strong man? I think
it probably is. Yeah. But in terms of executing gags in the manner that Keaton or Lloyd especially were great at, not only creating a gag that's visually inventive, but which convinces you that it's happening.
Right.
Lloyd will, Langdon will get in front of a rear screen at the drop of a hat.
Right. Right.
Which negates whatever he's doing.
Uh-huh.
If he's tumbling down a hill, but it's in front of a rear screen, okay. Not funny.
One of the comedians who faked it a bit, you know, like Larry Seaman or Monty Banks, you know. They were people who cheated.
Yeah.
Not that they weren't funny, but they didn't do it, you know, you weren't seeing what you were getting.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Or you weren't getting what you were seeing. I don't know. You weren't seeing something. Langdon,
you weren't getting what you were getting or seeing what
or
you were
seeing. What you were seeing. Yeah, okay. Well, that covers it.
Yeah.
Langdon did something in The Chaser, one of his last features, where he accidentally takes castor oil when he thinks he's taken poison to kill himself. This is how dark Langdon got. He was so edgy. He takes the castor oil, lays down on the kitchen floor, puts a cover over him, so when they find his dead body, he's already covered. And he lays there for what seems like an eternity. Doesn't move a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, you know that castor oil is working.
Sure.
And before you know it, he pops up, looks at the camera in panic, and runs out of the room. And I'll tell you something, Frank. It's classic. It's just wonderful Langdon comedy.
Yeah, that's the stuff that he excelled in.
Yeah. Now, how about his talkies? Let's talk about his talkies.
All of those seem like talkies made for somebody else.
I agree. I don't think he was successful. If you saw especially his early Roach stuff, I just find almost unwatchable. It's a very uncomfortable character with sound. You can accept it better in silent.
Yeah.
You know?
I saw a Langdon sound short. Maybe Stan showed it at one of his movie nights, which have not happened for a long time. So But
he moved.
It was the short where he ends up losing their apartment because of his dog, and he and his wife buy a trailer. Do you know that one?
Yeah, that's a Columbia.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, it's not that there weren't amusing moments in it, although there were very few, but he actually, with he's wearing glasses, he just doesn't look like Harry Langdon.
Well, we forget that he started later than all the other silent movie comedians. He was in vaudeville for years and years with his car act, you know, that automobile act.
Yeah.
And he got to the party late. So by the time he was making those Columbia films, he was nearing 60. And I don't think people realize that. It's just kind of sad to watch his regression. He did some fine work in there's two PRC films where he was teamed up with Charlie Rogers, Laurel and Hardy's old writer, director. And they were terrific together. And the films are not half bad. But for the most part, his talkie work, he's held back by the fact that when he talks, he sounds uncomfortably mentally challenged, maybe, you know, to the point where you almost feel sorry for him rather than, you know, laugh.
Yeah, it's another thing about, as we were talking about, the difference between silent personas and sound personas. And in this case, in the silent films, he had a persona that was not unlike a baby, like a big walking baby.
A baby man.
Yeah. And that is not a persona that can last you very long without seeming like you're a mentally challenged
man. When you're thrown into the reality of sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you can laugh at it when it's silent and it's clearly an abstraction.
Yes.
But once it becomes more realistic, it's the same thing. I mean, this is the cliche that people always say about Lloyd. That once when he's on top of a building and he's screaming,
and you can hear it,
and you know he's screaming help, you're just scared for him. You're not laughing
right.
at him.
Not
you
fun.
Know?
It's not as funny.
Yeah.
Although I do like the climb and feet first.
Well, it changes the
landscape.
The landscape a lot.
Yeah, right. It does. It does. Well, it's kind of like how I feel about the recent humor in movies today is what I call taking a crap in a hat. That's basically what gets laughs nowadays, it seems. But I can't take it. I'm not a big fan of bathroom humor in live films. Then I'll watch an episode of Family Guy where he'll do 10 minutes of that kind of humor, and I'll laugh till I cry.
Yeah.
I can take it in an animated form, because it's so unrealistic.
Yeah.
Where they're doing it in modern day films, to me, it's just kind of like, I got bigger laughs in the schoolyard, you know. It's that kind of thing. But that's the difference. I mean, Langdon had a very unbelievable character that you could believe in the silent milieu.
Yeah.
But the minute you heard autos honking and wives really yelling at him and bosses, dominating him, it wasn't that funny anymore.
Yeah, it's like any fantasy element. You can take Little Red Riding Hood out of her fairy story,
right,
and put her on Real Housewives of Atlanta, and she just becomes a weird.
Do you have any other fantasies, Frank?
Yeah, that's probably my most compelling one.
That's compelling. All
right. I think about it a lot.
Wait, I'm going to leave you alone for a minute. I'll be right back. I'm back.
Okay.
Anyway. But I'm just a big old comedy guy. I've got a million opinions, and
I think it's really great that you have been able to do these Biffle and Schuster things, to do the kind of comedy that nobody is going to ask you to do otherwise.
To emulate our heroes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so no matter what becomes of those films, you've got some great stuff that you've been able to act out that
yeah. Yeah.
that nobody else has been able to do, really.
Well, because... Well, there's a few reasons for that, of course. Of course, it's not people aren't clamoring for two real
sure.
vintage comedy. It seems like the Stooges own all of that
yeah.
nowadays. They're the ones. And if you had told me back then that out of all the great comedians from the past, it was the Stooges that were going to live and go on
yeah.
with modern times, I would have never believed it. Because they, to me, were... kind of on the same level as the cartoons I used to watch. You know, I loved them and they were hilarious, but, you know, none of them had the artistry of, say, a Chaplin or a Keaton or the Marx Brothers or Fields. And all of those people I just mentioned are more like footnotes compared
yeah.
to the Stooges, which is, you know, unfortunately, that's the template. People today like things fast, loud, and not very subtle.
Yeah.
And the Stooges fit the bill.
And they have just enough character so that they can do a character gag
yeah.
and be funny about it.
Yeah.
But not so much that you have to really think about it. They're stock types.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But they bring enough individuality to it that you know who and what Mo is and
oh,
who
yeah.
and what Curly is.
Yeah.
And
Mo's a homicidal maniac.
Yeah. it is strange about the Stooges because for my entire life, and they never, you know, they were through making shorts before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So they still made features. I remember seeing Snow White and the Three Stooges.
Oh, you're the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy. And even at that age.
You knew.
What was I, 7 or 8, something like that, yeah. as I think. I was going, like, ooh, boy, no.
We were all suspect of Curly Joe Derita.
Curly Joe was the worst.
Well, I have
I'm
to
sure he was a nice man.
I have to tell you one thing about Curly Joe, and I'm going to say this in his defense.
Okay.
I think just like Joe Besser, Joe Derita was out of his element
yeah.
with the Stooges. He looked like he was as short as Curly. He was rotund. He shaved his head. But if you watch one live sketch on the Steve Allen Show from 1958, I believe, they did the sketch that they did with Curly in the George White scandals of 1939, and it was about the stuntman. It's the stuntman sketch. Larry plays the star, and I think his name is Tab in the sketch. Mo is the director, and of course, every horrible thing that Larry has to do, they let the stuntman do, who's
sure.
Curly Joe Derita. And he doesn't speak a word in this sketch, and it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen the Three Stooges do,
wow.
period. And it's mostly because of him. So when he's given something that's his style, he's a very talented comedian. But
well,
with the Stooges, too mild, and too goyim.
Yeah.
He's the only goyim in the bunch. He didn't have that. He didn't have that.
Well, the same thing with Joe Besser, who I love.
Me too.
He's not a stooge. He doesn't
no.
work with him. And
mm-hmm.
whenever you see one of those things, he will get a laugh now and again.
Right.
But as Stinky and the Abbott and Costello
wonderful.
TV show.
Just wonderful.
Nothing funnier on earth.
Well, you know as well as I do, yeah. there are certain comedians that we love who should only be seen once in a while.
Yeah.
Or in small doses. Billy Gilbert is one of those with me. I love Billy Gilbert. I think he's hilarious. But you star him in something and you lose me.
It's too much.
There's
yeah.
too much. Joe Besser's that way, too. He's such a strong, interesting, nutty character that you could only take a little at a time,
yeah.
you know, to be effective. So he falls into that category. I'm trying to think of who else falls into that category.
Well, when I was growing up, Shemp fell into that category
mm-hmm.
with me and all of my friends because he always seemed like a poor substitute for Curly.
Unfortunately, that was the case with Shemp.
But now, of course, I revere Shemp.
Oh, I think he's wonderful.
I think he's – because you see all these other films, and every time he shows up, he's great.
Mm-hmm. I have to say
and
about
Shemp. And
he's
even better in The Stooges than we ever gave him credit for.
Oh, I agree. A good Stooge short with Shemp,
I'll
usually watch over a Curly. I know that sounds sacrilegious, but
– It does.
I OD'd on Curly to the point where I would rather watch a Shemp nowadays. I'm that way with the Paramount Marx Brother films. I've seen them so often and can recite them, you know, by rote, that I'd rather put on, and you're going to kill me, but I'd rather put on like The Big Store.
Wow.
Because it's, I don't know it as well. And I just think it's, you know, it's just by virtue of the fact that it's different.
We're going to go watch Duck Soup this very night.
Oh, is tonight we're doing Duck Soup?
Yeah. Are you coming?
Yeah, I'm coming. Oh, that's good. Tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Tobin. We're going to Tobin's.
Yeah.
Yeah. With Stan Taffel. Stan Taffel. Yeah. Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis, I think, was my first imitation when I was a child. I revered Jerry Lewis. Jerry Lewis was, he was such a hero of mine when I was a kid. And even into my teens, I couldn't tell a joke without adding a, my Val Hayden afterwards. And, had to learn not to do that when I got into professional comedy. Seriously, that's absolute truth. And I have to say, of all the comedians I grew up revering, he suffers the most. I find it very difficult to get through a whole film. I don't think he ever made a classic comedy. I'm sorry. None of the Dean and Jerry movies are that good. He's annoying in them. I remember recently watching a Colgate Comedy Hour with Dean and Jerry, starring Dean and Jerry. And my girlfriend, who did not grow up with these things, with any of these things, she's quite a bit younger than I am. She looked up after 15 minutes and said, "Boy, he likes to scream, doesn't he?" I was like, "Yeah, he does. He does like to scream."
There are very few Jerry Lewis films that work from front to back.
Absolutely.
But there are moments of such brilliance.
Oh, absolutely. There are moments here,
you know,
and there.
In The Ladies' Man, which I can almost take apart scene by scene and say, here's one that works.
Here's where it doesn't work. He had no idea about structure. No idea about, you know, writing believable characters.
No. And he's also selfish as can be.
Well, he was self-obsessed.
There's the scene in The Ladies' Man where he's delivering mail to all the different rooms of the girls, and they all have a shtick that they do as they get their mail.
Right.
But as soon as the door closes, he has to top them.
Right.
He has to get the laugh before he moves on.
And he should know.
He can't let these poor girls have the laugh.
Oh, no, of course not. And he should know more than anyone that a laugh on top of a laugh usually doesn't work. It's gilding the lily. But I find that his films are just kind of an excuse for Jerry excess. And no one was there to tell him to stop.
Yeah.
A lot of people will tell me, oh, no, you've got to watch the Tashlin films, To tell you the truth, they don't hold up.
No,
I'm sorry.
They're no better. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. There's some great sequences and some awful
stuff. I can think of some Jerry Lewis scenes that will make me tear up. They're so funny. I mean, really.
Oh, yeah.
And but then, you know, I've seen him live many times, and he's never as good as he thinks he is. And he's always got this attitude that you're so lucky to be watching me.
Yeah.
You people are so lucky. And you know what? I don't think he is one of the classic comedians.
It's the maudlin stuff that gets me.
Because
he can't pull it off. He tried to do what Chaplin could do, but he couldn't do it.
He's nowhere near Chaplin. And, he couldn't shine Chaplin's shoes.
But sorry.
And those are big shoes, I know.
Big floppy shoes.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that he did which I love so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like the opening scene of The Ladies' Man when he's being announced as the valedictorian.
Yes.
When his name is announced.
And he pops up.
He just springs out. And he doesn't spring up like he's standing up. No. Like he's been lying down and he springs straight up. He runs up, grabs the podium and says, "Thank you for choosing me." And then
there are moments that just kill me.
Yeah. And that is
lifting the weights in The Nutty Professor and his arms stretching and then the topper when he's in bed and he's scratching his feet. Jerry Lewis, he's got the right idea. He's got the tools. He just never learned to use them.
He never had the limits.
He never knew when to stop. He never knew what subtlety was. His movies are so maudlin, and some of the characters are just so conveniently dark, meaning to suit the purpose of the scene at the time.
Yeah.
Jerry's been doing, for the last 20 years, he's been rewriting his own comedy history, and so he'll look like he's more in line with people like Chaplin and Stan Laurel, but I'm telling you folks right now, he's nowhere near them.
Yes, I think what you should do is get the box set of Jerry Lewis films, as I have,
mm-hmm.
and then just go through and edit a one-hour reel.
And that's what you'd get.
And you would get an hour of the funniest stuff you've ever seen.
In his whole career.
Yeah. In the entire, yeah.
It's true. It's but, very true. But it would be probably pissing a lot of people off right now.
But it would
now,
be a solid hour
of hilarious and strong, stuff. Wonderful yeah. stuff. Yeah. Oh, my God. The things I think of. In the Patsy?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, oh, the whole thing with him recording the album, recording the song, and the three singers, you know. Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, that's wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it doesn't sustain through an entire film. And never mind. Don't get me started on his TV shows.
Oh boy. Oh, boy. Mm. Yeah. I've seen him live a couple of times. So I'm in Damn Yankees.
Uh-huh.
And then so I've seen him do Q&A stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he is not somebody I would like to know.
No. He's one of those people, like one of my comedy heroes, one of the few geniuses of comedy, and I say a few because there were only a handful, for real. One of them was Spike Milligan in England. He changed comedy forever with The Goon Show.
Sure.
But he's not someone you'd want to sit down and spend a delightful half hour with. He was not a very nice man. Jerry Lewis falls into that category. In my book, in fact, the title of the chapter I wrote about him was The Nutty Train Wreck. And I think that pretty much describes Lewis.
Whereas you could sit around with Oliver Hardy every day
And
probably have a pleasant time.
Have a very nice time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You certainly would.
Well, I've had a very nice time sitting around talking to you.
You too, Chuck.
Chuck.
What is your name?
Yes. Just Chuck will be fine.
Chuck. Okay. Chuck Fine. Nice to meet you, Chuck.
Chuck Fine is my name.
Yeah.
And so
Mo often chucked fine.
Well,
hey, Mo. But yeah, no, this
I have appreciated your coming over and doing this.
I had a ball.
Fun.
Let's do part two.
Okay.
All right.
We'll start now.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Nick.
Oh, you're welcome, Frank. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed that. As I listened to it, I noticed a couple of slip-ups on, well, one slip-up and then one just erroneous statement. One is, for some reason, I said Harvard Street Theater. Why did I say that? It's Harvard Square Theater. And it was such a hangout for me when I was in college and just after that I can't even imagine why I made such a slip up. But when you hear me say it, I'm not an idiot. I just went foggy a second. The other thing is that, you know, we talk about whether this will go up before or after CineCon. Well, it's gone up 2 weeks after CineCon. And as it turns out, the Biffle and Schuster short was not shown. So for all of you slapping your head saying, had I only been there? No, don't worry about it. It wasn't shown at all. There's still problems and getting it sorted out. So they'll be edited one of these days and we'll see them in all their splendor very soon. I'm a hoping. So thanks again to Nick. Great fun. And we'll have him back because we have fun talking. Hope you had fun listening. I have fun listening to Claire McCullough, my announcer, who announces on this, the commentary track, and also on Radio Movies. I want to thank my web designer, James Hutchins, who designed both my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, the musical geniuses who gave me my wonderful theme songs fore and aft. And I want to thank you, the listener, for passing the word around. It was really gratifying at CineCon this year because a lot of people came up to me and told me they are regular listeners of the podcast. This is important to me for two reasons. One, because I have an ego the size of all outdoors. I'm Jerry Lewis-like in my egomania. And so I always have to hear supporting things 24 hours a day. But the other thing is that there's really no way of telling how many people listen. Really, all I have to go by is how many reviews I have on iTunes and then how many people take the time to write to me and tell me if they listen and or people that I meet who tell me that they listen. And I hope that all of you who do like the show and have not gone to iTunes to give me a nice review will do so. It really helps. And I have a paltry number. it's all 5-star reviews, so everybody who goes there likes it, but I just don't have enough, so please help me out. I'm trying to get this thing rolling bigger and bigger, and after 2 years plus, I had hoped that I would be reaching a bigger audience by now, and I hope that I have not maxed out everybody on earth who would be interested in this podcast. So please go in and leave a nice review. You can support the podcast in other ways by donating money to it. When you go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, you'll see a donate button. Some people do that, and it is incredibly generous of them and is very, very welcome to get a little bit of money so that I'm only bleeding out less than I otherwise would. So that's nice. I'm far, far, far from being profitable on this thing. I doubt that I ever will be. But if I can get closer to just breaking even so that it doesn't start eating into the rent money just to keep this going, then that is a consummation devoutly to be wished. And of course, you can go through the Amazon portal on my website and clear your cookies and bookmark it and do all that other web stuff. Whatever you're going to order through Amazon, order through my site. Because when you do, I'll get a little bit of generosity from Amazon, and it won't cost you an extra penny. Not one penny. But gee, even if it was one penny, would that be so bad? But it's not. Not one penny. So I hope that you will go in and buy books or DVDs or Shetland ponies, perhaps a professional sports team, a large warehouse filled with baked goods. The bigger, the better. I just want you to buy whatever you're going to buy on Amazon. You can buy anything. They have literally everything. If you want a large gaseous star, not unlike the sun, I don't know if they have the sun itself, but they might. But you could probably get another star from another galaxy. And there's probably a bunch of them. You can compare prices. Whatever you have to do, buy that. Because the more you spend, the more cool stuff you get. And then the more little bit of gratuity I get from Amazon. That would be so nice. Oh well, I'm a dreamer, aren't we all? Got another great one coming up for you next week. As a matter of fact, this one was real fun. I recorded it yesterday, September 13th, if you're marking it home. It was a lot of fun. That's coming up next week. Just in case something happened with the editing, I won't tell you who it is. But join me anyway, won't you? And in the meantime, between then and now, please don't worry. We'll fix it in post.